Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Tax Resolution Institute's Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month. Our next call will be on April 3rd, so please mark your calendars. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you have logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants we have on today, we asked for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you did respond. After we answer those questions, and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. As a reminder, members, VIP members of our website get priority on these practitioners forum calls. So the first few questions, series of questions, are going to be from directly from members. Okay, we will announce. You know what? Before that, I go on. Let me also state that this month, because we are right in the middle of tax season, we're doing things just a little bit different. And at the later portion of our show, we do have one of our tax experts here to address tax-related questions to help you get through this tax season. So we are going to take some time to answer those questions. And again, thank you for those who submitted them ahead of time. But we will open this up to a Q&A session, and we will announce it once that Q&A session has begun. You can go ahead and type your question in the question box, or if you feel a little brave and you're not shy, you can just go ahead and indicate on the question section that you do have a question. We'll bring you on the call, make it live. You can ask the question live to our professionals here. Again, we will announce when that happens, and when that does happen, we will unmute you and you can speak to all of us. Now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. Joining us on the call today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As the leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Kreisman.
Good morning, everybody. Be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays. Each Tuesday, TRI offers something great. Today is the first Thursday of the month, and the first Tuesday of each month, we present the practitioner's call. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. On the second and fourth Tuesday of each month, we offer Tax Tuesday lightning deals. Be sure to come back regularly as the offers change each time. Get free stuff, amazing discounts, and much more. On the third Tuesday of each month, we broadcast our featured webinar. Learn audits, offers, installment agreements, appeals, and much more. If you forget what happens when, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And remember, we're here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Again, as I mentioned in the intro, these first few questions are coming directly from VIP members to our website. Aside from all the benefits that you get on the discounts on their site, you get consultation time and you get priority on these practitioners forum calls. So let's go ahead and get started. The first one is coming from Henry. He's an EA, and Henry wants to know, what is a typical timeline for getting a lien removed? I've never done a lien release and would like to know the general procedure.
Okay, well, there's a couple different ways that a lien can be removed. The easiest way is liens are automatically released when the collection statute expires. So if the lien is based on the 10-year assessment and the statute expired, the lien will automatically expire. Otherwise, if the tax is paid off early and you want the lien removed, usually the lien release takes about 30 days. So they ask not to call for 30 days. If after 30 days you check the account transcript and see that the lien is still on, then you would telephone the group. It's called the advisory group. It used to be called the lien desk. And you could call the advisory group and ask them to expedite the release of the lien, and they will. And you can ask them to fax you a copy of, it's called a facsimile release. And they'll do that too, and then you can have something in your hand right away.
All right, thank you very much, Norman. Moving on to another question from a member. This is coming from Jessica. Jessica says, my question is about CSED dates. We all know the statute for collection is 10 years from the IRS, but when that clock starts, it seems to be an ever-moving target. What are the common events that prevent the statute from continuing to run?
Okay, when the clock starts, I wouldn't call it an ever-moving target. It's very clear. The statute starts at the date of assessment. And if there's more than one assessment for a particular tax year, then there's more than one CSED date, because each assessment has its own expiration date. The things that stop the clock or tolls the statute are anything that would prevent the IRS from collection. Anything that stops collection stops the collection statute. So examples would be appeals, offers, requests for installment agreements, bankruptcies, if the taxpayer is out of the country for more than 6 months at a time, those kinds of things. And you would see that on the account transcript, and you could see when the clock stops and when it starts again. And also you need to keep in mind that they also add time. So something like, for instance, an installment agreement that was pending and then rejected, it stops the clock from the date that the installment agreement was started until 30 days after it was rejected. And that's because the taxpayer has 30 days after rejection of an installment agreement to appeal it. And if they appeal it, that continues the tolling on collection. But if they don't appeal it, then 30 days after rejection, the clock starts again. So you need to look at the account transcript and see what tolling events occurred, and then add some, like I said, sometimes it's 30 days. For bankruptcy, it could be 90 days from the date from when the bankruptcy was filed to when the bankruptcy was either dismissed or discharged, plus extra time. So you want to make sure that you have all those times if you're trying to figure out the CSET, because you don't want to be caught early. So it's 10 years plus the tolling.
All right, Jessica, hopefully that explains it for you. If not, take advantage of that consultation time. Give us a call and we'll walk you through it step by step. Okay, moving on to the next one. This is coming from Angie. Angie's also a member, and she's asking, I just engaged tax resolution clients who are married filing joint doctors. Husband is a plastic surgeon with $1 million in gross revenue, and wife is a holistic MD on target to make about $500,000 in 2018. She just started a private practice. Previously, she was earning $96,000 in a group practice. They have about $200,000 in net profit, but doesn't really have any cash flow to show. So no savings, no house, and empty 401k plans. They have about $50,000 in outstanding federal liability. Not sure of state yet. Looks like they live in Maryland, but they are in an installment agreement there. Their current accountant assumes they cannot qualify for OIC due to the level of gross income. They are both around 50 years old. They can't get ahead because this practice has high overhead and they have an autistic child with high medical bills. Both businesses are S-corps. Any general advice would be greatly appreciated.
Okay, so if they owe about $50,000, they would qualify for a streamline. and a streamlined installment agreement would take the $50,000 and divide it by 72 because it would be a 72-month payment plan. And that comes out to about $695 a month, or say $700. So if they could afford $700 a month, then they could do a streamlined installment agreement, very simple, and no financials necessary. If they can't afford the $700, then they need to complete a 433F and call ACS and read the numbers to them, and they would do a calculation. And if they have less than $700 a month disposable income, then they could be in an installment agreement that would be less than $700 a month. They probably don't qualify for an offer because $200,000 a year against standard expenses, national and local standards, they would have too much disposable income. The medical bills for the autistic child, that would all be allowed. But I don't know how much they're paying for rent and cars and other things, but my guess is it would be more than $700 a month. So hopefully they could just do the streamlined and pay the $700 a month, and it'd be easiest for everybody.
Yeah, so the standards here is something to take a look at, Angie. As Norman said, the high income is probably going to be way too much to allow for an offer. Hopefully that helps you there. Okay, moving on to our next member. This is Clifford, and Clifford is asking, the IRS appears to have a test program until September 30th of 2018 for streamlined installment agreements. It appears that the biggest difference compared to the existing program is that this one applies to assessed balances of up to $100,000. Can you compare versus the existing streamlined program? It appears that the biggest difference is that the federal lien could be filed besides the obvious threshold amount. My understanding was that the existing program of up to $50,000 balances owed does not include penalties and interest. Does the test now include penalties and interest and the $100,000? Was my understanding correct for the $50,000 threshold?
Right. So the new test program allows streamlined installment agreements up to $100,000, but there still is a difference between installment agreements 50 and below and above 50. And that difference is that if it's $50,000 or less, then it's a 72-month plan. So you would take the amount and divide by 72. If it's between 50 and 100,000, it's an 84-month plan. So you would take the liability and divide by 84, and that would be your monthly payment amount. Now, technically, that 50 and 100,000 threshold is for tax only. That's the assessed tax and not assessed and accrued penalties and interest. But it depends who you speak with. Sometimes you get somebody and they just take the total. Other people you talk to understand that it's just a tax. And so we've had people who owe over $120,000 and still qualify for the streamline because the tax portion was under $100,000. Or sometimes they'll allow you to pay it down. So even though they owe over $100,000, they could just pay the tax portion below $100,000 and still qualify for a streamline. But it would be then it would be the total remaining balance divided by 84. So it really depends on how much they owe, whether it's above or below 50,000. In terms of federal tax lien, again, it depends who you speak with. Some will file a lien if it's over 25,000, others if it's over 50. But if you do owe over 50, even with a streamline. And remember, streamlined installment agreements require a direct debit. So you have to give the IRS the routing number and account number and a date between the 1st and the 28th of the month for them to automatically take the money out of the taxpayer's checking or savings account. that's part of the deal. They don't allow the taxpayer to mail in checks every month. They take the money out from the account automatically. And the lien will be filed. But you can get the lien released if the tax gets below $25,000 and you've had the installment agreement set up as a direct debit and it's been successful for at least 3 months. Then there's a form that you can fill in asking that the lien be withdrawn, and that and the reason would be because of the direct debit installment agreement.
All right, Clifford, hopefully that answers your question there. Moving on to John. John is asking, in the event of an IRS audit, if the taxpayer has canceled checks to prove expenses but does not have invoices, is there any audit defense in this situation?
There is a defense, but it's a partial defense because you really should have both. But my question would be, like, who are the checks made out to? I mean, if they're made out to AT&T an obvious, Ford Motor Company or something, I think that's pretty clear. Also, does the memo portion of the check specify what it's for? And are the checks made out monthly, and are they made out for roughly the same amount every month? So you could probably do it if they all said, you know, we're all made out to Ford Motor, and they were all for the same amount, and they were all the first of every month. But generally, you would want to have both canceled checks and invoices, and ideally, you would have the invoice number on the check, on the memo line of the check, so that they could reference each other. But I would say it's not dispositive that. If you only have the canceled checks, I would still give it a try. It may still work.
All right, John, give us a call if you have any further questions regarding that. Moving on to Richard. Richard is asking, I have a case that has been with an RO for over 18 months. We formally requested an installment agreement, and the RO has not made a formal decision. I don't want to contact the RO since there hasn't been any collection activity for my client. My question is, will the pending installment agreement toll the CSET date the entire time? The liability is from 2007 and was hoping to run out that clock.
Yeah, the bad news is that a pending installment agreement does toll the statute. But I would order an account transcript and take a look and see if the request for an installment agreement is on the transcript. So the thing is, are you really doing the taxpayer a favor by having them keep a pending installment agreement request open, tolling the statute, and penalties and interest continue to accrue? So now 18 months have passed and they owe more now than they did 18 months ago. So what have you really accomplished? And the collection statute is tolled. So you may want to advise the taxpayers to make voluntary payments. That would go a long way too to establish what the taxpayers are comfortable at paying every month. But I don't think this is a situation where you should just ignore it, because it's not going to go away. And like I said, the taxpayers owe more now than they did when it started. So you really haven't accomplished anything. And the collection statute is tolled. So once the offer is either accepted, rejected, or withdrawn, then that statute's going to stay tolled. So I would advise you to do something, because you're not getting anywhere. You're not getting anywhere now, and I believe that tax resolution is just that. It's resolving the taxpayer's problem, not just kicking the can down the road and doing it for another day. Let's resolve it now. That's what the taxpayer's paying us for. So you may want to contact a revenue officer, or at least instruct the taxpayers to make monthly voluntary payments in an amount that they're comfortable with so that they can at least start getting that tax liability down.
All right, Richard, some good advice there to help you with that client and address their issue sooner rather than later. Moving on to the next one. This is from Becky. And looking at penalty abatements, if the taxpayer has been denied the first-time penalty abatement, what are acceptable reasonable cause arguments that can be made to have the penalties abated?
So usually reasonable cause arguments, you can divide into two different groups. One is blame the professional. So in that case, it's the CPA or the tax preparer or the tax attorney's problem that they did something wrong, that they gave the taxpayer bad advice, wrong advice, and the penalty would not have incurred but for the taxpayer reasonable reliance on the advice of a tax professional who turned out to be wrong. You have to be kind of careful on that because some things are considered reasonable reliance and some aren't. Like, so for instance, on the issue of whether or not to file a tax return, that's something that a tax professional could instruct the taxpayer. And so the taxpayer may not have filed a return because their tax professional told them that the return wasn't necessary. But the due date of a return is something that the IRS says the taxpayer can easily figure out themselves. So you can't rely on a tax professional to tell you the due date of the return. And if they were wrong and you get assessed a late filing penalty, that was the reasonable cause because of your reliance on the tax professional. The other kind of reasonable cause is based on the taxpayer, and that is that the taxpayer, for some reason, couldn't do what he needed to do, and when he could, he did as soon as he could. So examples would be if the taxpayer was in the hospital, or if he was sick, or if he had mental problems, that kind of thing. And you can back it up with a doctor's note or something else that would justify why the taxpayer couldn't file the return or whatever timely, that that he had a good reason and that would excuse the neglect, and you could abate the penalty based on that.
All right, Becky, some good arguments there for reasonable cause. Moving on to the next question, it's Charles. I just heard back from an offer specialist on an offer and compromise I submitted almost a year ago. They disagree with the income based on deposits made in the taxpayer's personal bank account and are recommending denial of the offer, stating taxpayer has ability to full pay. My client is a construction worker and has changed jobs several times over the last couple of years and now happens to be unemployed. We disagree with the specialist but don't know where to take it from here. How do we get them to see the reality?
So there's a section in the IRM, the Internal Revenue Manual, on income averaging. And what it says to the offer specialist is if a taxpayer has fluctuating income or fluctuating job stability, that you can average it over the past 3 years. So what I would do is get 3 years worth of tax returns. So I would either do 14, 15, and 16, or if you can get them to complete the 2017 return, I would submit 2015, 16, and 17 and average those 3 years total income, and that would be the average income over the 3 years, and that's the income that I would use, so that if it works in your client's best interest, where maybe 17 was a good year, but 15 and 16 weren't so good, or some other combination, but by averaging the income over 3 years, hopefully you can get a better look, and the average will be lower than the obviously lower than the highest year, and you could do that. So we just had an appeal that on something similar, and we suggested income averaging, and we did that, and it worked out. So look at the last 3 years' income and average it out, and hopefully that will give you a number that everybody can work with.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Jesse has a bankruptcy question. A client of mine filed for bankruptcy Chapter 11 in 2013 and is currently making payments on the trustee. He started to receive notices of tax due from the IRS for years 14 and 15, which are significant. Can he get the liabilities included in the BK plan, or can he file for Chapter 7 now? He's not sure what to do, and his bankruptcy attorney has retired.
Okay, so there's a couple red flags here. First of all, in a normal Chapter 11, the debtor is his own trustee. And so when he's making payments to a trustee in a Chapter 11, that tells me that there was a problem and the debtor was forced to have a trustee assigned to his case. Usually the U.S. trustee brings a motion in bankruptcy court and a trustee is appointed. So that's not good, because the whole thing of Chapter 11 is that you're your own trustee. The other thing is that the 2014 and 15 taxes are post-petition taxes, because those are taxes that were incurred after the filing of the bankruptcy. And there's a provision for post-petition taxes called administrative claims. And administrative claims are priority claims that get paid in the bankruptcy. So he may ask the IRS to file an administrative claim in his 11, and he could pay those taxes in the 11. Otherwise, the IRS may file a motion to dismiss the case because he incurred post-petition taxes. Or you may convince the IRS not to file the motion to dismiss the case, because since those taxes are post-petition and not paid in the bankruptcy, that he would still owe those taxes anyways. As to filing a Chapter 7, he couldn't file a Chapter 7 while he's in an 11, only one bankruptcy at a time. So he may convert to a 7. I don't know what his situation is or whether or not that would help him or not. Again, 14 and 15 would be administrative claims and not dischargeable in a 7. So he would still owe the taxes even after a Chapter 7 discharge. He should get a bankruptcy attorney. I mean, if his bankruptcy attorney retired and his Chapter 11 is still pending. But if it was filed in 13, I would think that 11 must be wrapping up. And he also needs to make some provision so he does continue to incur post-petition tax liability. So someone needs to talk with the IRS and see what the IRS is willing or not willing to do. And again, the choices would be an administrative claim. The IRS could file a motion to dismiss, or the IRS could agree to do nothing and allow the 14 and 15 taxes to survive the Chapter 11.
All right. Thank you, Norman. If I may just take a quick minute. As you can see by the questions that are being submitted, they cover a lot of different topics. In our firm, we're pretty well versed in a majority of all tax related issues, including bankruptcy, including regular resolution and tax problems. So the reason why I say this is because We do offer consultation time to members where you can feel comfortable in asking us any question to be able to resolve your issue or help you with that one tough case that you need to get past. You know, one of the things that I want to offer, and we always offer for people on this practitioner's forum, is to become a member. I do have a 2-month free trial of the membership. I'm going to push a link now for those of you who are interested. And let me just read off real quickly some of the things that you guys get with the membership. And comes included with up to 3 hours of consultation time. You get free access to videos on demand. So, you know, if you're up at night and you're thinking about, okay, I need to learn a little bit more about resolution, you can click on the video on demand section and look at past webinars that we've done. Look at the installment agreement, offers and compromise, penalty abatement, lien releases. All these are topics that we cover there. You also get access to our comprehensive knowledge base. You get e-learning courses that have exams and tests at the end. We do offer CPE credit for that. You also get to attend free webinars, and you get 20% off on site-wide discounts. So take advantage of it. I'm going to be pushing the link now so everyone becomes aware of that, and hopefully you join and become part of the membership team here, and we can help you with your cases. In the meantime, let's go ahead and keep moving this along, because we do have a lot of questions to get to, and I want to make sure we also answer these tax-related questions. Next is from Matthew. And Matthew says, I have a client that missed the audit and is now assessed additional tax. It has been over a year since the audit was performed. What is the process to have the audit reopened to show the expenses?
Okay, so there's usually two stages to an audit. The first is a 30-day letter, which tells the taxpayer if you disagree with the auditor's report, you can send a letter to the auditor explaining why you disagree and submitting any new information that you have or documentation to support your position that the audit is incorrect. If that doesn't work, then the next stage is the auditor submits a notice of deficiency, which is called a 90-day letter, because it allows the taxpayer 90 days to file an appeal in U.S. tax court by submitting a petition. If they don't do that, then after that time, then the audit assessment becomes final. And at this point, I think the easiest way to get another chance is to file an offer doubtis to liability. So an offer doubtis to liability says that you have to say that you owe something. You can't say zero. So the expenses that you can prove, you can say, you know, I can prove some of these expenses, and so I disagree with that. There's some expenses I can't prove, so I'll agree to that assessment. And the offer doubtis to liability would take it to a new auditor, and you'd be able to present all your expenses. Hopefully you have invoices and canceled checks to support your expenses, and you could reopen the audit that way.
All right, moving on to Howard. Howard's asking, if the IRS issues an SFR and the taxpayer eventually files an original return for the same year, from what date does the collection statute of limitations begin to run? SFR date or file date of return? Please explain.
Okay, so every assessment has its own collection statute expiration date. So if the SFR was assessed, then that assessment expires after 10 years. If the taxpayer files a return, a subsequent return, and that return shows actually more tax than the SFR did, then you'd have another assessment for additional tax based on the filed return, and that assessment based on the filed return would have its own CSAD. If the filed return showed less tax, then there would be there'd be a deduction, but that's not an assessment. So it would be the assessment on the SFR. So you're going to have either, depending on whether or not the filed return shows more or less tax than the SFR, you're either going to have one CSED, which corresponds to the assessment of the SFR, or two CSEDs, one based on the assessment of the SFR and one based on the assessment of the filed return.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Moving on to Tish. Tish has a question about, will the IRS make you sell your home that has a lot of equity before putting you in non-collectible status? And what about the other assets, cars, collectibles, et cetera?
Yeah, the IRS really doesn't want your home. The reason they have a federal tax lien is as if you sell it or refinance it, that they can get some money out of it. But if you have equity in your home, you're not going to qualify for currently non-collectible, because they're going to say that you can take out a home equity loan and pay them. So what you want to do in a situation like this is have the taxpayer apply for a home equity loan, keep a copy of the application, and then if the home equity loan is denied, you want a copy of that denial letter, and you send the IRS a copy of the denial letter, and then they know that the equity in the home is unreachable by the taxpayer, and then they would base the amount that the taxpayer could pay in an installment agreement, or whether or not they qualify for non-collectible status, based on their income and expenses. So it's really important, if a taxpayer has equity in their home, the first thing you want to do, because it's a long process, is to have the taxpayer apply for a home equity loan. And in this case, sometimes you're hoping that the home equity loan is denied, which is fine, but you want to keep a copy of the denial letter and also a copy of the application, because you want hopefully that the numbers on the application matches the numbers on the 433F or 433A, so that the IRS can see that you submitted proper financials to the bank before they denied your home equity loan.
All right. Thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and change gears here a little bit and move over to the tax questions. I know a lot of you have been submitting your questions online, and I'm going to get to you, Clinton, Yushun, Sylvia, Ryan, Brian. You guys have been going on here and asking these questions. I'm going to try to get to you, but I'm going to skip ahead and go and address some of these tax questions, because, again, we wanted to do things a little bit different for tax season. If you do have tax-related questions, please go ahead and enter them in the question box now. We're going to go ahead and let me introduce first Sohail Rabbani. He's one of our tax experts here at the Tax Resolution Institute. And Sohail's taxation experience includes extensive knowledge in the areas of individuals, partnerships, LLCs, C and S corporations, multi-state taxation, and FAS 109. He has industry experience, including investment management, real estate, healthcare, and entertainment, both in the public and private arenas. His track record of taxpayer representation for government taxation agencies, for instance, the IRS and the FTB, is exemplary. Sohail has been involved with numerous compilations and reviews of financial statements for high net worth individuals and their closely held businesses, as well as audits of manufacturing and investment management companies. So we brought on Sohail today to be able to address some of these tax questions, being that it is tax season. So I'm going to go ahead and ask Sohail the first one, and just go ahead and speak clearly. The microphone will pick you up from there.
He will.
Okay. Yeah. So first one is coming from Kin, and Kin wants to know, I have a question that I've never encountered before. I have a client who sold a single-family home rental property with a gain, but reinvested into a similar rental property within the same year of purchasing, a year of purchase price greater than what he sold his rental property, including capital gain. So, for example, he bought his first property for $65,000, put in another $15,000 for renovation to improve the property in order to make it rentable. After 4 years, he sold his first rental house for $120,000, which resulted in $35,000 capital gain. He bought the second single family home rental property in the following month in the same city about 7 miles away, paying $179,000. How do I report that to offset the capital gain? I spent days searching online, but cannot find the answer. I called the tax pro hotline at the IRS, and they said that my question was out of their scope. So hopefully it's not beyond our scope. So
well, first of all, good morning to all the participants of this program. Unfortunately, I have to be bearer of bad news. You're not going to be able to offset the gain with the reinvestment, because in order for you to be able to accomplish that, you needed to have done a 1031 exchange. So you have, in order to do a 1031 exchange, you need to work with an accommodator. And the property that is sold, the single family resident rental property that was sold, needed to have gone through a 1031 exchange, and the taxpayer should not have touched the cash, should have been in the accommodator's hands. And when the taxpayer found the replacement property, he the accommodator would have purchased that property for the taxpayer. Thereby, you could defer the capital gain to future. Now, of course, there's basis issues, carryover issues, which makes it a little bit more complex to deal with. But that is the only way that your client could have avoided avoided currently on paying the capital gains tax by deferring it to the future, to the replacement property. The only other way that he can mitigate the capital gain is if he has capital losses from previous years that have carried over, then you can offset the capital gain against the capital losses from prior years. So that is, unfortunately, your client's situation. He could have avoided the capital gain tax currently by doing a 1031 exchange.
All right, Ken. Sorry to be bearer of bad news there, but at least going forward, you know that the 1031 is an option. I do have a follow-up question here from Martin Sohel. He's asking, is a 1031 exchange a good method to postpone the gain on a sale of a rental and purchase another? So if you can
always very simple, always.
And again, you said you needed an accommodator.
No, yeah, here's the thing. If you're doing a 1031 exchange, either your accountant or your broker can refer you to an accommodator, because all they do is work on 1031 exchanges to so you're not running afoul of the code and regulations. Because there are a lot of very stringent rules involved with 1031 exchanges. For example, you need to complete a 1031 exchange within 180 days, or roughly equivalent to 6 months from the time the relinquished property has been sold, and that is defined by time when the escrow closes. So, for example, if the escrow closes today, March 6th, you have 180 days from today to purchase your replacement property. But you have 45 days to identify what that replacement property will be. So there's a lot of nuances, and someone that really understands the 1031 exchange should help you when you decide to, anytime you deal with real property, you should have someone that understands 1031 exchanges before you go forward.
All right. Thank you very much, Sohel, for that. Moving on to the next question. This is from Sargiana, who's an EA. She's asking, can a non-resident alien file a fiscal year return if established with the first tax return filed? I have filed for non-residents of Australia on a fiscal year ending June 30th, which corresponds with the Australian tax year, and the service has processed the returns on the calendar year. I established that their tax year ending June 30th with the first return filed on their form W-7.
Well, the IRS, I forgot the code section exactly what it was, which requires individuals to file on a calendar year basis. Generally, corporations, partnerships, and personal service corporations are the ones that request a fiscal year, which is any 12-month period that ends other than December 31st. The only exception for an individual to file a fiscal year return, and I'll give you the citation for it, publication 538 from the IRS, IRS publications. Individuals, the only time they can file a fiscal year is when they have books and records. And the books and records are defined as any advance payment, including gross receipts on your tax return for the year you receive payment, must not be less than the payment you include in income for financial reports under the method of accounting used for those reports. Generally, individuals use are under the cash method of accounting. Therefore, it's very, very rare that it happens that an individual is on a fiscal year. And there are some taxpayers that are on fiscal year, but those are individuals that have been grandfathered from many years ago when individuals were able to choose to select easily a fiscal year. So unfortunately, again, to be bearer of bad news, I find it highly unlikely where your individual from Australia keeps books and records and has advance payments to keep track of their books and records. So again, sorry to be bearer of bad news in this case.
All right. Hopefully that helps you, Sarjana. Moving on to the next tax-related question. This is from Robert. Robert wants to know, what forms do we need to file if a self-employed individual made excess contributions to his SEP account? Limit for 2016 is $53,000. Actually, before you start answering that question,
can we have Norman chime in and chime in, and then we'll go back to that one.
Okay, sounds good. I'm going to open it up, guys, for you guys that are on the line. Any tax-related questions, please go ahead and submit them now. But I'm going to go ahead and ask a question from online. It looks like Sylvia wants to know, Norman, if I understand this correctly, when we submit an offer, all collection activity stops. What if a client has an existing installment agreement? Do they have to continue making the payments? What if during the processing of the offer, a tax return is due that will have a refund? Would the IRS keep that refund? Where will it be applied?
So an offer filed in good faith stays collection. So if the taxpayer has an installment agreement and is submitting an offer, it doesn't seem to make sense that they would continue making payments on the offer, since the making payments on the installment agreement, since the offer is going to satisfy the liability. So I would stop making payments while the offer's pending. As to tax refunds, yes, the IRS will keep the tax refund for the year that the year or years that the offer is pending, plus the year that the offer is accepted. So that refund will go to the IRS. But I don't see the point in making installment agreement payments while an offer is pending.
Okay. Hopefully that helps you there, Sylvia. Moving on to Ryan. Ryan is asking, I have submitted an offer last month and waiting for the IRS to confirm the receipt or the acceptance. How long will this take, and will it toll the statute while being reviewed?
So the first question is, yes, it will toll the statute. The statute is tolled from the time that the offer is submitted to the time that the offer is either rejected, accepted, or withdrawn. And the statute is tolled for that period. And how long does it take? Usually after we submit an offer, we get a letter. It used to be like 30 days. Now it's more like 60 or 90 days. And then the letter says, receives your offer will contact you within 90 days. And then 90 days later, you get another letter that says, we need another 90 days.
Right.
So I'm just telling you that offers are taking quite a long time right now, that I wouldn't be surprised if it's a year from the time that you submit the offer till an offer specialist actually contacts you. And so you really want the taxpayer to stay in compliance during the time that the offer has been submitted but not reviewed yet by the offer specialist, which means continue making your estimated payments, things like that. You don't want them to incur additional tax liability. You want to make sure that they're making all their estimated payments.
All right. So expect several of those. I need more 90 days from the IRS because they do come often. Moving on to Mary. I'm sorry. I skipped Brian. Let's do Brian's question here. Brian has, client has a large liability of approximately $300,000 since 2009. She appealed the assessment in tax court in 2011 and lost. Can she now file for BK since it's been over 6 years since original tax was assessed?
Based on the information that you've given me, I would say yes. But before filing a bankruptcy that's trying to discharge tax liability, I would always pull the account transcripts and do an analysis, because you don't know if something's popped up that you're unaware of, but the tax should be dischargeable in a current bankruptcy. But you always want the bankruptcy attorney to do a tax dischargeability analysis based on the account transcripts to confirm that the tax is dischargeable.
Keeping on with the bankruptcy topic here, Norman Martin is asking online, my client filed Chapter 13 almost a year ago, and their payments to the trustee for payback over 5 years is 100% payback. Is this correct and reasonable? Also, the trustee charges approximately $1,400.
Right. So a couple things. First of all, that's correct. The Chapter 13 has a Chapter 13 trustee, unlike a Chapter 11. Also, a Chapter 13 plan is only feasible if it pays secured claims and priority claims in full. And general unsecured claims, a percentage pro rata to the general unsecured creditors based on the taxpayer's ability to pay. If it's 100% plan, what that tells me is that the debtor has sufficient disposable income to pay off his general unsecured creditors in full over the life of the plan. And that's okay. And yes, the trustee charges a trustee's fee. That's a statutory fee for distributing the funds every month. So that everything seems to be normal.
All right. Thank you for that. It's time to come back to Sohel. Sohel, are we ready to address Robert's question?
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to ask it one more time. So Robert is asking, what forms do we need to file if a self-employed individual made excess contributions to his SEP account? Limit for 16 is $53,000.
All right. If you discover an unwanted contribution after the final tax filing deadline, which I assume it is for here because you're asking for 2016, you might have to pay the 6% excise tax, which you report on Form 5329 and 5330. If you're younger than 59 and a half, you might also have to pay the 10% penalty for an early withdrawal. You can choose to return the excess contribution to your employer or to contribute it to your own IRA. You can carry forward in your IRA the portion of your excess contribution that is greater than the IRA annual contribution limits. You will have to pay 6% excise tax each year on the remaining balance until you use up the excess amount. So There's your answer.
All right. Thank you very much. Robert, hopefully that answers your question there. And again, if it doesn't, give us a call. Try that trial membership, and we can do, you know, get you in contact with Sohail so we can use some of that consultation time. Moving on to the next questions that were submitted here online. This is coming from Mary. Mary says, I've heard conflicting answers to this question. Can you please clarify if taxes can be discharged if the client did not file their own returns and the IRS filed SFRs?
So I assume that you mean discharge in bankruptcy. And unfortunately, the answer is that SFRs are not dischargeable in bankruptcy because in order to discharge taxes in bankruptcy, the taxpayer debtor has to have filed a return. So an unfiled return is not dischargeable.
Got it. There you go, Mary. Next question is from Anthony. Anthony's asking, I set up a streamlined installment agreement, but a year into it, my client assessed new liability. We just received a notice of intent to terminate the installment agreement. Can I call the IRS and set up another installment agreement for the new liability? Can we maybe combine the amounts owed and just have one installment agreement? Any advice is appreciated.
Yeah, you could only have one installment agreement at a time. So you wouldn't have a separate installment agreement for the new liability. But what you could do is call and ask them to put the new liability into the existing installment agreement, and it may result in the taxpayer's monthly payment to go up. So be prepared for that. And also be prepared to answer questions on what the taxpayer is doing so that they won't owe additional taxes again next year. So, you know, are they making their estimated payments? Is there sufficient withholding from their wages? So you just want to make sure that it's not going to happen again. But, yes, it is possible to roll the new liability into the old and come up with a installment agreement to cover everything. But the monthly payment is probably going to go up.
Right. Okay. And Norman, I have this question from Yushun online. As everyone knows, tax liability is made up of basically three separate, the tax, the penalties, and the interest. And Yushun is asking whether or not the interest can be abated.
No, except interest on penalty. If you can get the penalty abated, then the interest on the penalty will be abated. But interest on tax, no.
Right, but the interest on the penalty can be abated once the penalty is abated.
Correct, yes.
Right, so that answers that question there, Yushun. Clinton Donnelly is online, and he's asking a question. I have a client with over $100,000 in taxes owed this year. He is willing to agree to an installment agreement. He believes he can pay off the taxes by end of the year when he sells some investment assets. We hear that often, by the way. Must he liquidate assets now to pay as much as he can, or can he simply agree to the installment agreement?
I would agree to the installment agreement first. So if he owed like $100,000 and you did an 84-month streamlined plan, I think that comes out to like $1,200 a month or something. And remember, an installment agreement is a ceiling, not a floor. I mean, a floor, not a ceiling, which means they're going to take $1,200 a month automatically from his checking account or savings account every month. But if he wanted to pay more to pay it down faster, you could always go online and pay extra. So there's nothing that prevents you from doing that. And if he decides that he wants to liquidate assets or whatever, he can always pay it down or pay it off. But I would set up the installment agreement first so that the taxpayer is safe from forced collection.
Right.
And also, like we said, you know, we hear this all the time. And so the taxpayer will say, can you just buy me 60 or 90 days and then I'll be able to full pay? And then we buy the 60 or 90 days. And when the 60 or 90 days come, the taxpayer is not able to pay in full. And so then we have another problem. So I would always suggest, especially on a streamline, to set up the installment agreement first and then kind of take the pressure off and then work at paying it off when you can.
Right. That's the best advice there. All right, guys and gals, this is the end of this month's Tax Resolution Institute Practitioners Forum. I want to thank Sohail and Norman again for joining us today and answering these questions. As a reminder, you guys have consultation time if you're a member to call us, set up a time, speak to them directly, or any other of our professionals to help you with your tax resolution questions, tax questions. We even do marketing and sales questions, bankruptcy questions, anything related to our field of expertise to help you resolve these issues. So thank you all once again. Remember, next month, it is April 3rd is our next practitioners forum. So again, we will be asking for questions to be submitted prior to that call. But thank you all. Hope you have a great tax season. We're right in the middle of it. So go get through those returns. Thank you, guys.